So, before we jump into today's deep dive, I just want to throw out a really quick heads up. This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Yeah, and they've actually got a completely full Series 63 course.
Right, with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flash cards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge for pacing yourself.
Exactly. So definitely check that out at CertFuel.com. Anyway, let's set the stage for today.
Let's do it.
Picture this scenario for a second. We've got this guy sitting in a really dingy, you know, boiler room style office in the middle of New York.
Oh, classic.
Right. He picks up the phone, dials a number, and sitting on the other end of that line in this quiet suburban living room in New Jersey is a retiree, someone who just inherited a decent chunk of money.
And we all know where this is going.
Yeah. The guy in New York pitches a completely bogus high yield guarantee return investment. Just lies through his teeth.
Knocker.
And the retiree in New Jersey, unfortunately, buys it and loses absolutely everything. Now, before we even talk about the crime itself, a massive jurisdictional war breaks out.
Right. Like, who actually gets to investigate this?
Exactly. Who has the power to bring the hammer down on this guy in New York? Does New York take the case because, you know, the call started there?
Or does New Jersey take it because their resident was the victim? Or, wait, is it just a federal SEC issue?
See, that is the single most important question a securities regulator asks before they even open a file. Do we actually have the authority to act?
Yeah, jurisdiction is everything.
So we are going to answer that question today, because if you are listening to this, you are likely in the trenches prepping for the Series 63 exam.
And this stuff is critical.
Right. Our mission today is absolute ironclad retention of this beast of a topic, which is state enforcement and anti-fraud authority.
We're talking about the rules that govern exactly when a state can step in, you know, who they can go after. And this is key. The one universal rule that absolutely nobody can escape.
No matter how clever they think they are.
Exactly. And I really want to emphasize this for everyone listening. Lock in right now, because this specific material is prime exam real estate.
It's like, what, a 9% weight block on the exam?
Yeah, it's massive. The exam writers absolutely love testing the exact microscopic boundaries of these rules.
They really do.
They'll present these scenarios that seem to have really obvious answers, and I guarantee you the obvious answer will be a trap.
So to make sure you, the listener, don't fall into those traps, we really need to move away from just like reading a dry textbook.
Good, because that puts me to sleep.
Same. I have ADHD, so dry lectures just completely lose me. We're going to look at how these rules operate in the real world. We're actually going to use a recurring cast of characters today to test the limits of these laws.
I love that. Applying a face to a legal concept is really the best way to cement it in your memory.
Right. So let's meet the cast. First, we have Fraudster Fred.
Fraudster Fred. Okay, I'm picturing like slicked back hair, terrible cheap suit.
Yes. Picture Fred as slick, arrogant, and relentlessly greedy. He spends his days just trying to find clever legal loopholes to scam people.
He genuinely thinks he's smarter than the state administrator.
Oh, 100%. He is the guy making that bogus phone call from New York.
Honestly, Fred is the entire reason these laws were written in the first place.
Truly. So second, we have Advisor Alice.
Okay, what's Alice's deal?
So Alice is not a criminal. She's really well-meaning. She genuinely wants to help her clients. But, this is a big but, she is a walking disaster when it comes to compliance.
Oh, a compliance nightmare.
Exactly. She's got post-it notes everywhere. She's constantly tripping over technical regulatory rules. She loses paperwork. And she literally thinks a friendly handshake is a substitute for a mandatory disclosure form.
Oh, wow. Yeah, she represents a completely different kind of danger to the investing public, really.
Right. The danger of just pure incompetence.
Which can still wipe out your life savings.
Exactly. And finally, we have Buyer Bob. Bob is just a regular guy.
Good old Bob.
He works hard, he saves his money, and he's just trying to invest without getting taken to the cleaners by Fred or, you know, accidentally having his life savings tied up in litigation because Alice lost a trade ticket.
Okay, so Fred, Alice, and Bob, keep those three in your mind, everyone listening. We're going to put them through an absolute gauntlet of state regulations today.
We have to start at the foundational level, though. Before you worry about how to register a security or like what specific form a broker dealer needs to file, you have to understand the rule book itself.
The foundation.
Right. The entire state securities regulatory system is built on this thing called the Uniform Securities Act.
Yeah.
You'll see it abbreviated as the USA.
And the most critical thing to understand about the Uniform Securities Act, and this is a huge test point, is that it is not actually a federal law.
Right. Congress did not pass it.
The president didn't sign it. It's essentially just a model template.
Like a blueprint.
Exactly, a blueprint. It was drafted by the Uniform Law Commission and then heavily amended over the years by NASA.
That's the North American Securities Administrators Association, for anyone taking notes.
Right. And just think about the logistical nightmare of having 50 different states trying to write 50 completely different sets of securities regulations from scratch.
Well, it would be chaos.
Total chaos, the overlap, the contradictions, the massive compliance headaches for literally any firm trying to do business across state lines.
Yeah, I mean, if California requires a red disclosure form and Nevada requires a blue one, and you live on the border, your business just grinds to a halt.
So the Uniform Law Commission created this master template. The idea is that each individual state legislature takes this blueprint, reviews it, maybe tweaks a tiny definition here or there to fit their specific state constitution, and then enacts it into their own state law.
Gotcha.
When you hear the term blue sky laws, this is exactly what they're talking about.
Okay, let's pause on that term for a second, because blue sky laws is such a, it's such a strange poetic phrase for a deeply dry piece of financial legislation.
It really is.
Where does that even come from?
So it actually dates back to the early 20th century, specifically around Kansas in 1911, though the Supreme Court later really cemented the phrase.
Okay, what were they doing in Kansas in 1911?
Well, you had these incredibly smooth-talking promoters traveling from town to town, just snake oil salesman types.
Right.
They would pitch these highly speculative, completely fraudulent investments to farmers and small-town residents.
Like what kind of investments?
Oh, they were selling share in gold mines that literally didn't exist, or oil wells that were completely dry, just totally making it up.
And a Supreme Court justice famously described these promoters as having nothing to back their investments except the blue sky itself.
Right.
Yeah.
She said they were selling building lots in the blue sky.
No, they were basically selling thin air.
Exactly. So the states realized they couldn't just sit around and wait for people to get robbed and then try to prosecute the promoters for common law fraud after the money was already gone.
Because the guys already skipped town with the cash.
Right. They needed a preventative framework. They needed these blue sky laws to force these promoters to register themselves and their securities before they could sell a single share.
Which brings us to a massive glaring trap that the Sirius 63 exam writers absolutely love. I want you, the listener, to pay incredibly close attention to the year I'm about to say.
Oh, this gets so many people.
The Uniform Securities Act has been updated a few times. There is a modernized, updated version from 2002 that addresses the digital age, electronic records, modern market structures, all the stuff you'd expect.
But the exam does not test the 2002 version.
Let me repeat that. It does not test the 2002 version. It tests the Uniform Securities Act of 1956. Yes, 1956.
Wow.
We are testing a legal template written when the primary method of communication was literally a rotary phone and the postal service. Why? Like, why would a modern regulatory exam force you to memorize a law from the Eisenhower administration?
It basically comes down to the friction of state politics. Look, NASA can write a brilliant modernized template in 2002, but NASA doesn't actually have the power to make it law.
Only state legislatures can do that.
Right. And passing complex financial legislation is rarely a top priority for a state senate. So while maybe about 20 states have adopted the 2002 version, the vast majority of states are still using the 1956 version as the core baseline of their blue sky laws.
So NASA, the organization that writes the exam, is basically stuck.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot practically update the test to the 2002 rules until a clear majority of the states are actually operating under them.
Exactly. So if you see a question on the exam asking which version of the USA is the basis for the test, or if a rule seems strangely analog or old school, lock into the 1956 Act.
As amended by NASA.
Right. Never select the 2002 option if it is presented as a distractor. It is a trap.
Okay, so this 1956 blueprint is broadly organized into four distinct parts.
Yeah.
Now, you don't need to memorize the table of contents, but knowing the structure really helps you understand the tools the administrator actually has.
Yeah, it gives you the lay of the land.
Right, so part one covers fraudulent and other prohibited practices. This is the anti-fraud section.
Heavy hitter.
Yep. Part two covers the registration of persons, meaning the broker-dealers, agents, investment advisors, and investment advisor representatives.
Basically, the people doing the selling and advising.
Right. Then part three is the registration of securities, which details how an actual stock or bond gets cleared for sale. And part four is general provisions, which covers definitions, exemptions, and the jurisdictional scope we're going to tear into shortly.
But before we get into jurisdiction, we really have to tackle a concept in Part 3 that trips up thousands of test takers every single year. It revolves around what registration actually means.
Ah, yes, the approval fallacy. This is a foundational concept. Listener, hear me clearly on this. The state administrator never, under any circumstances, approves a security.
The word approved is practically radioactive on this exam. If you see it, run.
Let's explore why. Think about going to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Everyone's favorite place.
Right. Let's say buyer Bob takes a heavily used, rusted out 1998 Honda Civic to the DMV to get it registered. He stands in line, fills out the paperwork, pays his registration fee, and the clerk hands him a license plate and a little sticker for his windshield.
Okay, I'm with you.
Now, listener, ask yourself this. Does that sticker mean the state DMV has officially approved Bob's car as a fantastic, reliable vehicle? Does it mean the state guarantees the engine won't explode on the highway on the way home?
Of course not. The DMV doesn't employ mechanics to inspect your transmission.
Exactly. The registration simply means Bob filled out the required forms, he provided proof of insurance, and he paid the tax. The registration is just effective.
Securities registration operates on that exact same philosophical logic. When a company wants to sell a stock in a state, they file a massive stack of paperwork with the administrator.
They provide financial statements, details about the management team, disclosures of the risks.
Right. And the administrator's staff reviews that paperwork. But what are they actually looking for?
They are looking for completeness. Did you disclose everything required by law? Did you pay the filing fee? Are the financial statements audited properly?
And if the answer is yes, the administrator clears the security for sale. The registration simply becomes effective.
The administrator does not pass judgment on whether the company's business model is brilliant or completely idiotic.
They really don't.
Like, if you want to start a company that sells dehydrated water.
Dehydrated water. I love it.
And you fully, honestly disclose in your prospectus that your product is scientifically impossible and investors will likely lose 100% of their money.
The administrator will probably make your registration effective because you disclose the risk.
Right. The state operates on a disclosure philosophy, not a merit philosophy, at least at the baseline level of the Uniform Securities Act.
Yeah, they basically believe adult investors have the right to make terrible financial decisions as long as they are fully informed about how terrible the decision is beforehand.
Which is where advisor Alice constantly gets herself in trouble. Let's bring Alice back in.
Oh, Alice, what does she do now?
So, Alice is sitting across the desk from buyer Bob. She really wants Bob to invest in a new tech startup. She wants him to feel safe. So she leans in and says, Bob, you have nothing to worry about. This stock is totally state approved. The administrator looked at it and gave it the green light.
Yeah, Alice just committed a criminal offense.
She literally just lied to make him feel better.
Under the USA, it is explicitly unlawful to make any representation that the administrator has passed upon the merits of, recommended, or approved any person, security, or transaction.
By telling Bob the state approved it, Alice is creating this false sense of security. She is transferring the burden of due diligence from herself onto the government in Bob's mind.
Which is exactly what the state doesn't want.
But wait, what if the security in question doesn't even need to be registered? What if Alice is selling Bob a U.S. Treasury bond? Treasury bonds are exempt securities, right?
Right. They don't go through the state registration process at all.
So can Alice say, Bob, this bond is so safe, the state approved an exemption for it?
No, that is just as unlawful. Being exempt from registration does not equal approval either.
So they don't approve registered securities and they don't approve exempt ones.
Correct. The administrator does not approve exempt securities and they do not approve registered securities. Any language, printed or spoken, suggesting the state has endorsed the investment is a direct testable violation.
Okay, so if you, the listener, see the words approved, endorsed, or recommended by the administrator on exam day, immediately flag it as a false statement.
The only legally acceptable term is that the registration is effective.
Got it. Okay, now that we know what the administrator does and doesn't do, we have to figure out where their power actually reaches. We have to draw the borders on the map.
This brings us back to our opening scenario, right? The phone call from New York to New Jersey. The jurisdiction of the administrator.
Because financial transactions don't happen in a vacuum. Money moves at the speed of light. an email crosses three state lines before you can even blink.
Exactly. So the USA has to cast a very specific net to figure out when a state's regulator is actually allowed to step in.
But before we cast the net, we need to know what the net is made of. We need to define what a state actually is under this law.
This is a great place for a pop quiz.
Good idea. Let me ask you, the listener, a direct question. Think about this. Frost or Fred is sitting in Florida. He makes a phone call and sells a completely bogus, fraudulent security to buyer Bob.
Okay.
But Bob isn't in Florida. Bob is currently living in San Juan, Puerto Rico, drinking a piña colada.
Sounds nice.
Does the Uniform Securities Act apply to Puerto Rico? Listener, take a beat. Does it apply? The answer is yes.
Yeah, the definition of a state under the USA is intentionally really broad. Obviously, it includes all 50 states, but it also includes any territory or possession of the United States.
That means Puerto Rico, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands.
It also explicitly includes the District of Columbia. Every single one of those jurisdictions has its own administrator, its own set of blue sky laws based on the USA, and its own power to enforce them.
So an offer directed into Puerto Rico is legally an offer directed into a state.
But here's the flip side of that rule and a very common exam trap. Let's change the scenario just a little bit. Fred is still in Florida, but he calls Bob, who is currently on a business trip eating poutine in Toronto, Canada.
Okay, Canada.
Is a Canadian province a state under the USA?
No. The definition of a state stops at the US border. Foreign countries, Canadian provinces, Mexican states. They are not states under this act.
Right. However, and this is crucial, that does not mean Fred gets away with the fraud.
Wait, why not?
Bob is in Canada, so there is no U.S. receiving state. But where did the call originate?
Florida.
Right. Because the transaction touched a U.S. jurisdiction on the originating end, the Florida administrator has full authority to investigate and prosecute Fred. The transaction is still subject to the USA, even though the receiving end was international.
Oh, that makes sense. Which perfectly transitions us into the mechanics of how jurisdiction is actually triggered. The USA uses what is known as the two-prong test.
Yeah, it's essentially a set of triggers for the sell side of a transaction and a mirrored set of triggers for the buy side.
And the exam leans really heavily on the sell side, right?
Very heavily. So let's unpack that first. The sell side reaches persons who offer to sell or actually sell a security. Jurisdiction applies to a state if one of two things happens. Prong one, an offer to sell is made in the state, or prong two, an offer to buy is made and accepted in the state.
Okay, I want everyone to look really closely at the phrasing there. If Fraudster Fred merely makes an offer to sell into a state, jurisdiction is triggered instantly.
Instantly.
He doesn't need to close the deal. He doesn't need to take a single dime of Bob's money. The simple act of extending the offer gives the administrator power.
But look at prong two. If Bob approaches Fred and makes an offer to buy, jurisdiction isn't triggered for the seller until Fred actually accepts that offer in the state.
Okay. And the buy side test is the exact inverse.
Right. Exactly. It reaches persons who buy or offer to buy a security. Jurisdiction triggers if an offer to buy is made in the state or an offer to sell is made and accepted in the state.
Now, this sounds perfectly balanced on paper. Sell side, buy side. But there is a massive exam trap hiding in here.
Oh, it's huge.
The sell side and the buy side are not equal in their power or their consequence.
Not all.
The sell side triggers the entire weight of the USA. It triggers anti-fraud rules, registration requirements, and crucially, civil liability.
Civil liability is the private right of action. It means if someone breaks the rules, you can sue them in civil court to get your money back, plus interest and attorney's fees.
And this remedy is called rescission, right?
Correct. But the buy side test never triggers civil liability. It also never triggers securities registration.
Wait, I really want to dig into this because you have to ask why. Why would the law allow a buyer to sue a seller, but not allow a seller to sue a buyer?
It's all about historical context. Let's use our characters to illustrate. Fred sells a stock to Bob. Fred lies about the company's financials to make the stock look incredibly valuable. Bob buys it, the company goes bankrupt, and Bob loses everything.
Poor Bob.
Right. Under the sell-side civil liability rules, Bob can sue Fred for rescission. He can force Fred to take the worthless stock back and refund his money.
That makes perfect sense. The law is designed to protect the investing public from fraudulent promoters. We want Bob to get his money back.
Right. Now let's completely reverse it. Let's say Bob owns some stock in a small mining company. He doesn't really know what it's worth.
Okay.
Fred, who has inside information that the mining company just struck a massive vein of gold, approaches Bob. Fred downplays the company, tells Bob the mine is mostly empty, and offers to buy Bob's shares for pennies on the dollar.
Okay, so Fred is scamming him on the buy side this time.
Exactly. Bob agrees and sells. A week later, the gold strike is announced and the stock skyrockets. Fred just made a fortune by defrauding Bob on the buy side.
Fred absolutely committed fraud, so the anti-fraud rules still apply, right?
Right.
The state administrator can still suspend Fred, fine him, send him to jail.
Yes, absolutely. But Bob? Bob cannot use the civil liability provisions of the USA to sue Fred to get his stock back.
Wait, why not? He was robbed. He got scammed.
He was. And he might have remedies under common law fraud or federal law, but the specific civil liability provisions of the Uniform Securities Act were fundamentally designed to address the historic problem of promoters dumping worthless paper on the public.
Oh, like the blue sky salesman in Kansas.
Yes. They were designed to unwind bad sales. They were not structurally designed to force a buyer to return a highly valuable asset. They tricked someone into selling too cheaply.
That is fascinating. So on the exam, sell side triggers civil liability. Buy side does not. Defrauded sellers cannot seek rescission under the USA.
Drill that into your head. Now that we know what triggers jurisdiction, we need to know where those triggers actually occur geographically. We need to define when an offer is actually made in a state.
I call this the splash zone rule.
The splash zone. I like that.
Because jurisdiction is almost never confined cleanly to one single place. It basically splashes outward from the point of contact.
Right. The legal definition is that an offer is made in a state when it originates from that state, or R, when it is directed to that state and received in the place to which it is directed.
Okay, let's bring it back to our opening scenario. Fraudster Fred is sweating in his New York boiler room. He dials the phone. Buyer Bob answers in his living room in New Jersey. Fred pitches the scam.
A tale as old as time.
Listener, I am asking you directly. Think about the splash zone. Who has jurisdiction over this specific phone call? New York or New Jersey? The answer is both, simultaneously. The splash zone covers both of them.
To understand why, you really have to look at the motivations of the two state administrators. The New York administrator is looking at Fred sitting in Manhattan. New York does not want to be known as a safe haven for financial criminals.
Right. They don't want their state borders used as a base of operations to launch attacks on residents of other states.
Exactly. So New York claims jurisdiction because the offer originated there.
They just want to clean up their own backyard.
Precisely. Meanwhile, the New Jersey administrator has a completely different motivation. Their primary mandate is to protect the residents of New Jersey from financial harm.
And Bob is sitting in New Jersey.
Right. The deceptive offer was directed into their state and received by their resident. So New Jersey claims jurisdiction because the impact happened there.
The moment that connection is made, both administrators have full overlapping authority to investigate Fred, subpoena his records, and issue enforcement actions.
And it gets even more complicated because physical presence isn't actually required for the splash zone to hit you.
Wait, really? Let's do a scenario for that.
This is a classic exam hypothetical. Let's say Fred decides phone calls are too risky. He decides to use the mail.
Very old school.
He prints up a glossy, totally fraudulent brochure and mails it. He addresses the envelope to Bob's primary residence in New Jersey.
But wait, it's February. Bob is a snowbird.
Ah.
He is spending 2 months renting a condo in Miami, Florida. So Bob has gone to the post office and set up mail forwarding. Fred's brochure arrives at the New Jersey post office, gets a little yellow forwarding sticker slapped on it, and is transported all the way down to Florida.
The long journey of the fraudulent brochure.
Bob opens the brochure while sitting on a beach in Miami. Listener, who has jurisdiction now, think about it. New York, New Jersey, or Florida.
Okay, let's trace it. It originated in New York, so New York has jurisdiction. Now, where was it directed?
Well, Fred directed it to New Jersey. He physically wrote a New Jersey address on the envelope.
And did it arrive at the place to which it was directed? Yes, it arrived at the New Jersey post office facility. Therefore, New Jersey has jurisdiction.
What about Florida, though? Bob actually opened it and read it in Florida. The fraud hit his brain in Florida.
Florida does not have jurisdiction.
Wait, really? Not at all.
Not at all. The rule is hyper-specific. It says the offer is made where it is directed and received at the place to which it is directed. Fred had absolutely no idea Bob was in Florida.
He didn't direct the offer to Florida.
Exactly. The state of Florida cannot assert jurisdiction over an offer that simply passed through its borders because of a personal mail forwarding arrangement.
That is fascinating and incredibly testable. The originating state and the originally directed state, that's the splash zone.
Right. But Everything we've talked about so far involves one-to-one communication, a phone call, a letter. What happens when the communication isn't one-to-one? What happens when it's one to a million?
Oh, mass communication. Let's say Advisor Alice wants to grow her business. She doesn't just want to call Bob. She wants to reach everyone. So she buys a full-page advertisement in the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
That newspaper gets printed and then shipped on trucks to all 50 states. It lands on driveways from Maine to California. Under the splash zone rule, Alice just directed an offer into 50 separate states, and it was received in 50 separate states.
Sounds like a compliance nightmare for Alice.
Yeah, does Alice have to register as an investment advisor in all 50 states just to run one ad?
No, if that were the case, the entire financial publishing industry would just instantly collapse. The regulatory burden would be impossible. So, the Uniform Securities Act carved out specific safe harbors. We call these the media exclusions.
Okay, these exclusions are designed to prevent absurd regulatory overreach. They define specific types of mass media that do not trigger jurisdiction in a state, even if residents of that state consume the media.
The first major category is out-of-state broadcasts. This covers television and radio.
Right, because radio waves do not stop at the state line. If you broadcast a radio show in Chicago, the signal easily drifts over the border into Indiana and Wisconsin. So how do we determine jurisdiction?
Jurisdiction for a broadcast is tied exclusively to the physical location of the microphone or the camera. That's it.
So if Fraudster Fred hosts a shady financial advice radio show, and he is sitting in a studio in Georgia, speaking into a microphone, Georgia has jurisdiction.
Yes. Even if the radio station's transmission tower is so powerful that a million people in Alabama and Florida listen to the show every single day, Alabama and Florida do not have jurisdiction over that broadcast.
Because the offer did not originate there.
Right. And because it's a mass broadcast, the USA excludes it from the directed and received trigger in those receiving states.
What if the signal is picked up by a relay station in Alabama and rebroadcast?
It doesn't matter. The physical location of the original microphone is the only thing that anchors jurisdiction.
Okay, so that's broadcast. The second category is out-of-state publications. This applies to bona fide general circulation newspapers and magazines.
And bona fide means it is a real newspaper. It has news, opinions, sports. It is not just a promotional catalog created by a broker-dealer to sell their own products.
Got it. So if a bona fide newspaper is published in State A, but it is circulated in State B, State B has no jurisdiction over any financial advertisements inside that paper.
Exactly. Take the Wall Street Journal. It's published in New York. When it is delivered to a subscriber in California, it is an out-of-state publication for California.
The California administrator cannot claim jurisdiction over the advertisers in that paper based solely on the paper arriving in Los Angeles.
Right. It is automatically excluded because it crossed the state line. Which brings us to the most convoluted, highly testable math problem on the Series 63.
The infamous two-thirds rule.
This rule trips up more people than almost anything else. We really need to take this very slowly.
Let's do it. The two-thirds rule only applies to in-state publications. We just established that if a paper crosses the border, the receiving state ignores it. But what about the state where the printing press is actually running?
Right, the originating state.
Does the publishing state automatically have jurisdiction over every ad in the paper?
Usually yes, because the offer originated there. But the USA created an exception for newspapers that are printed in a state, but primarily serve a national or regional audience outside that state.
Here is the rule, listener. If a newspaper is published in a state, BUT, more than two-thirds of its total circulation over the past 12 months, was outside of that state, then it is excluded from jurisdiction even in the state where it is published.
Let's build a scenario to make this concrete. Let's bring in Advisor Alice. Alice buys an advertisement in a newspaper called the Border Town Bugle.
Great name.
The Bordertown Bugle has its printing press and headquarters in State A, but it is a very unique paper. Because State A is a tiny state right on the border, 80% of the people who subscribe to the Bugle actually live across the border in State B.
Okay, so total circulation. 20% stays inside State A where the ink hits the paper. 80% is loaded on the trucks and driven across the border into State B.
Listener, I have a question for you. Think about the math. Does State B have jurisdiction over Alice's advertisement?
Wait.
The answer is no. But I want to ask you why. Is it because of the two-thirds rule? Is it because 80% is more than two-thirds?
No. And this is exactly where the exam trapped you. They will put all this math in the question to distract you. For State B, the Bugle is printed in State A.
Therefore, for state B, it is an out-of-state publication.
Exactly. It's automatically excluded. State B does not care if the circulation is 10%, 50%, or 99%. It crossed the border. It's excluded.
The two-thirds rule math only matters for state A. State A is the one running the printing press. Normally, they would have jurisdiction. But they look at the past 12 months. They see that 80% of the papers went outside their borders.
And 80% is greater than roughly 66.6%.
Right. Because more than two-thirds of the circulation went out of state, the publication is excluded in state A as well.
So in this specific scenario, neither state A nor state B has jurisdiction over the advertisement itself.
What if the numbers were flipped? What if 60% of the papers went to state B and 40% stayed in state A?
Well, state B still has no jurisdiction. It's still an out-of-state paper for them. But state A runs the math. 60% went out of state, 60% is less than two-thirds. Because they failed to hit the two-thirds threshold, the exclusion does not apply in state A. State A retains full jurisdiction over the ad.
The math only matters to the state where the ink hits the paper.
Okay, I want everyone listening to pause whatever you are doing right now. If you are walking, stop for a second. If you are driving, keep your eyes on the road, but really focus your brain on what I'm about to say.
Here it comes.
Because I am about to introduce a concept that shatters everything we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the follow-up trap.
The media exclusions are a shield, but they are a very, very narrow shield.
The media exclusion only protects the media itself. It protects the publication of the advertisement. It does not protect what happens next.
Let's go back to fraudster Fred. Fred understands the two-thirds rule. He specifically buys an ad in a national magazine that is fully excluded from jurisdiction in every state. It's a completely deceptive ad for a Ponzi scheme.
Typical Fred.
Buyer Bob sees the ad in the magazine. Bob thinks it looks interesting, so he fills out the little contact me for more information card in the back of the magazine, writes down his phone number, and mails it to Fred.
Okay. Fred gets the card. He looks at Bob's New Jersey phone number. He picks up the phone and calls Bob directly to pitch the scam. Listener, does the media exclusion protect Fred's phone call?
Yeah.
Not a chance.
The moment Fred picks up that phone and dials Bob's number, he creates a brand new, direct, targeted offer. The mass communication is over. The media shield completely evaporates.
By calling New Jersey, Fred just activated the splash zone. The offer originated in Fred's state, and it was directed to and received in Bob's state. Both administrators instantly have jurisdiction over that phone call.
You cannot use a media exclusion as a magical force field to protect your direct sales efforts. The moment you follow up on a lead generated by a mass ad, you are subject to the two-pronged jurisdiction test all over again.
The administrator is always looking for the direct interaction, the point of contact.
Everything we have discussed so far, the sell side, the buy side, the originating state, the media exclusions, these are primarily designed for transactions, buying and selling securities.
Which means they heavily govern broker-dealers and their agents.
Right. But the financial world isn't just about transactions. It's also about ongoing advice.
Which brings us to a massive expansion of power, the Investment Advisor Instrumental Act provision.
When we shift our focus from broker-dealers to investment advisors and investment advisor representatives, the state administrator throws a much wider net.
For an advisor, the state doesn't just look for a completed offer or a closed sale. Jurisdiction is triggered if any act instrumental in affecting prohibited conduct occurs in the state.
Any act instrumental. Those words are doing a lot of heavy lifting.
What does that actually mean in practice?
It means the administrator doesn't have to wait for the final transaction.
Hmm.
If an advisor does anything, even preparatory, logistical, or supporting activities that are instrumental in setting up a violation, the state where that activity happened has jurisdiction.
Why the double standard, though? Why do broker-dealers get the fairly clear-cut offer and acceptance test while advisors are subjected to this incredibly murky instrumental act standard?
It essentially comes down to the fundamental nature of the relationship. A broker-dealer is executing a transaction. It's an arm's-length event. An offer is made, a price is agreed upon, money changes hands. It's discreet.
Right.
But an investment advisor provides an ongoing service. Bob is paying Alice for her judgment, her analysis, her continuous management of his portfolio over time. It's a fiduciary relationship.
Because it's an ongoing relationship rather than a single event, the fraud or the violation might be a slow burn. It might involve a lot of moving parts spread across different states before Bob ever realizes his money is gone.
Exactly. The law allows the administrator to look at the entire web of the relationship.
Let's put advisor Alice in a scenario. Let's say Alice's business is struggling. And she decides to launch a highly deceptive fraudulent wealth management scheme.
Going to the dark side.
Yeah, she lives in California. Her clients are in California. But she wants to host a massive launch event for this scheme. She rents a ballroom at a luxury hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. She pays for the room, sets up the projector, and prepares her fraudulent presentation.
So far, she hasn't actually made an offer to sell a security. She hasn't taken any money. All she did was rent a room in Nevada.
Can the Nevada state administrator assert jurisdiction over Alice based on that hotel rental?
Yes, they absolutely can. Securing that venue was an act instrumental in effecting the prohibited conduct. She was laying the physical groundwork for her fraud within the borders of Nevada.
Wow.
Even if all her victims are from California, and she herself is from California, Nevada has jurisdiction over her actions because she used their state to facilitate the scheme.
The net is incredibly broad, but there is a crucial caveat here that the exam will definitely test you on. This broad instrumental act trigger does not apply to every single rule in the Uniform Securities Act.
Correct. The administrator cannot use the Instrumental Act clause to enforce mundane technical rules across the board. The statute explicitly limits this broad trigger to three specific areas.
Number one, the advisory anti-fraud rules. If you are setting up a scheme to defraud clients, any Instrumental Act triggers jurisdiction.
Number two, investment advisor registration requirements. If you are acting as an advisor without being properly registered and you do something instrumental to that unregistered business in a state, they have you.
And number three, rules against unlawful representations,
right?
Like lying about your qualifications or claiming the state approved you.
It's a broad net, but it's highly targeted at the core protections involving the fiduciary duty of advice.
Okay, we have spent a lot of time defining the borders. Mm-hmm. We know what a state is, we know how jurisdiction splashes, we know how the media exclusions work, and we know how far the net reaches for advisors.
We have built the arena.
Now, it is time to look at the absolute most important rule inside that arena.
This is the centerpiece of the entire Blue Sky regulatory framework.
The universal anti-fraud provision.
It is the ultimate backstop. It catches everything that falls through the cracks of registration and exemptions.
The universal anti-fraud provision applies to every single person. It applies to every single security. It covers offers, it covers sales, and it covers purchases. And here is the biggest gotcha on the entire Series 63 exam. I need you to burn this into your memory.
There are absolutely zero exemptions to the anti-fraud provision, none.
Let me set up a scenario that exam writers love to use to trick people. Fraudster Fred has been reading the USA. He thinks he's a genius.
Always dangerous.
He discovers that certain securities are exempt from registration, meaning he doesn't have to file paperwork or have them reviewed by the state. U.S. Treasury bonds, for example, are exempt securities.
Because they are backed by the federal government, the state doesn't need to review them.
Right. Fred also discovers that certain types of transactions are exempt. For instance, an isolated non-issuer transaction or a specific type of private placement.
Yeah.
So Fred gets his hands on some exempt U.S. Treasury bonds. He then arranges to sell them to buyer Bob in an exempt private transaction.
He has an exempt security, and he is selling it in an exempt transaction.
He is double exempt. Fred feels invincible. He gets Bob on the phone and says, Bob, I have these special Treasury bonds. I can guarantee you a 25% annual yield, and they come with a free timeshare in the Bahamas.
A timeshare and a Treasury bond.
It is a massive, blatant, ridiculous lie.
Bob believes him. Buys the bonds at a massive markup and realizes he's been scammed. Bob complains to the state administrator.
The administrator knocks on Fred's door. Fred laughs and says, you have no power here. The security is exempt. The transaction is exempt. I didn't have to register anything with you. I am outside your jurisdiction.
And the administrator issues a cease and desist order, freezes Fred's assets, and refers him for criminal prosecution.
Because exemption from registration never means exemption from fraud liability.
You can be selling the most heavily exempted security in the world in a transaction so private no one else knows about it. The moment you lie, cheat, or steal, the universal anti-fraud provision crashes down on you.
Fraud is fraud.
The state does not care if the product itself was exempt, if the method used to sell it was deceptive.
So what actually constitutes fraud under this provision? The statute breaks it down into three specific prongs.
Prong one makes it unlawful to employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud.
This is your classic deliberate scam. This is Fred setting up a fake shell corporation, printing glossy brochures for a gold mine that doesn't exist, and actively stealing money. It requires a deliberate scheme.
Prong two makes it unlawful to make any untrue statement of a material fact or to omit a material fact necessary in order to make the statements made in the light of the circumstances under which they are made, not misleading.
Yeah, it is a lot of legal jargon, but it basically boils down to two things: outright lies and half-truths.
The outright lie is simple. Fred tells Bob the company has $10 million in revenue when they actually have zero. That is an untrue statement of a material fact.
And a material fact is anything that a reasonable investor would consider important when making a decision to buy or sell.
Right. But the omission is where it gets tricky. Fred calls Bob and says, Bob, this tech company just doubled their user base in the last 3 months. That is a 100% true statement. The user base did double.
But Fred intentionally omits the fact that the company's server costs tripled, they ran out of cash, and they are filing for bankruptcy tomorrow.
By omitting the bankruptcy, Fred made his completely true statement about the user base deeply misleading. That is a lie of omission, and it violates prong two.
But prong three is where the law gets truly fascinating, where advisor Alice gets into massive trouble.
Oh, this is the one.
Prong three makes it unlawful to engage in any act, practice, or course of business which operates or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon any person.
Operates as a fraud. Focus on those words.
Let's run a scenario with Alice. Alice is not fraudster Fred. She does not wake up in the morning plotting to steal Bob's money. She has no intent to defraud anyone.
Great, she's just disorganized.
Right. Her office is a disaster zone. She has paper stacked to the ceiling. Bob gives Alice a check for $50,000 to invest in a safe mutual fund. Alice accidentally drops the check into a file folder for a highly speculative, high-risk options trading account.
Oh, no.
The money gets invested in options, the market crashes, and Bob loses all, $50,000.
Bob was defrauded of his money.
But wait. Under common law, to prove fraud, you usually have to prove scienter. You have to prove intent. You have to prove the person meant to deceive you. Alice didn't mean to do it. She was just incredibly, catastrophically clumsy. Does she violate the universal anti-fraud provision?
Yes, she violates prong three. And this is exactly why prong three was written. It is an effects-based standard, not an intent-based standard.
The Uniform Securities Act specifically states that the terms fraud and deceit are not limited to common law deceit.
The administrator doesn't have to read Alice's mind. They don't have to prove malice.
They only have to look at the result. Alice's sloppy course of business operated as a fraud on Bob. The effect was that Bob's money was destroyed through negligence that crossed the line into a fraudulent outcome.
Think of it like walking down the street and stepping on someone's foot, breaking their toe. Under prong one, you saw their foot, you aimed for it, and you maliciously stomped on it.
Ouch.
Under prong three, you were just walking clumsily while looking at your phone, and you crushed their toe by accident. Either way, the victim has a broken toe.
The law protects the victim's outcome, not just judges the actor's intent. That is such a crucial distinction.
So if Fred deliberately violates prong one, or Alice clumsily violates prong three, what happens next? What tools does the administrator have to punish them?
The USA provides a tiered menu of sanctions. The first tier is administrative action. The administrator has the power to suspend, deny, or revoke registration. They can take away your license to work in the industry within their state.
But the most powerful administrative tool is the cease and desist order. This is a direct command from the administrator to stop whatever activity you are doing immediately.
And here is a terrifying fact for anyone operating on the edge of the rules. The administrator can issue a cease and desist order with or without a prior hearing.
Think about the immense power of that. If the administrator believes you are currently engaged in a fraud that poses an immediate danger to the public, they don't have to wait to schedule a court date.
They don't have to let you present your defense first.
No. They can issue a piece of paper today that legally forces you to shut down your entire operation instantly. You can request a hearing to argue about it afterward, but the shutdown happens first.
It's the ultimate emergency break. Now, the administrator does not have the power to actually put you in handcuffs or throw you in a jail cell themselves. For that, they have to move to the next tiers, judicial and criminal.
If the administrator wants to compel you to do something rather than just telling you to stop, they go to a state court. They can ask a judge to issue an injunction.
They can ask a judge to order rescission, forcing you to buy back the securities. They can ask for restitution, or they can demand disgorgement, which forces you to hand over all the illegal profits you made.
But what about prison? Everyone wants to know what it takes to actually end up behind bars under state securities laws.
I'll ask you directly, listener. Does Alice's clumsy paperwork mistake, which operated as a fraud under prong three, send her to state prison?
Yeah.
No. Administrative penalties do not require intent. But criminal penalties absolutely do.
To face criminal charges under the Uniform Securities Act, the state prosecutor must prove that the violation was willful.
Willful. That is the magic word for criminal liability.
It means you acted intentionally. You knew what you were doing. Interestingly, it does not necessarily mean you knew you were breaking a specific law.
If Fred deliberately prints fake stock certificates, he is acting willfully. Even if he somehow didn't know the exact statute he was violating, he intentionally committed the act. He is subject to criminal prosecution.
Alice was just clumsy. She didn't willfully deposit Bob's money in a wrong account. So she faces administrative sanctions, maybe civil lawsuits, but not jail.
For those who do act willfully, like Fred, the Uniform Securities Act sets specific maximums for state criminal penalties.
The exam tests these numbers constantly. Under the 1956 Model Act, the maximum state criminal penalty is a fine of up to $5,000, imprisonment for up to 3 years, or both.
$5,000 in 3 years.
Remember, that is per violation. If Fred ran his scheme on 100 people, the prosecutor can stack those charges. And that is just state law. Federal penalties under the SEC are vastly more severe. But for the Series 63, you are memorizing the state caps, $5,000 in 3 years.
So we have this universal anti-fraud provision that covers everyone. It catches Fred, it catches Alice, it catches anyone buying or selling.
Huh.
But what if you aren't just selling a sock?
What if your entire business model is giving people advice?
What if Bob is paying you specifically to tell him what to do with his money?
If you cross that line from salesperson to compensated advisor, the regulatory net tightens significantly.
This brings us to the advisory anti-fraud provision. The state holds investment advisors to a much higher standard than regular broker-dealers.
It's rooted in the concept of fiduciary duty. A broker-dealer transaction is generally considered arm's length. The broker wants to sell, you want to buy, you agree on a price.
But when you hire an investment advisor, you are paying for their loyalty. You are trusting them to put your financial interests above their own.
Because that trust is so easily abused, the law layers on extra protections.
This specific provision applies to anyone who receives compensation for advising others on securities.
And this is key. It applies whether you are officially registered as an investment advisor or not. If you are getting paid for the advice, you are subject to the advisory anti-fraud rules.
The rule starts out looking very similar to the universal provision. It makes it unlawful for an advisor to employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud a client. It bans any practice that operates as a fraud on a client. But then it adds specific prohibitions tailored to the advisory business.
It explicitly grants the administrator the power to define and ban dishonest or unethical practices. Notice that doesn't say fraudulent.
A practice might not rise to the level of criminal fraud, but if the administrator deems it unethical for a fiduciary, they can ban it.
The provision also adds a very specific ban on misstatements made during the solicitation of clients.
This separates the act of giving advice from the act of getting the client in the first place.
Let's use Alice again. Alice wants more clients. She runs a local radio ad and says, "Hire me as your advisor. My proprietary algorithm has beaten the S&P 500 by 10% every single year for the last decade."
Which is a complete fabrication. Bob hears the ad, comes into her office, and signs an advisory contract.
Alice violated the solicitation clause. Even if every single piece of actual investment advice she gives Bob from that day forward is perfectly sound and honest, she committed fraud by lying to get him to sign the contract. The solicitation is heavily regulated.
You cannot lie to get them in the door. And you cannot lie once they sit down. But the absolute gold mine for exam questions in this section, the concept they will test from 5 different angles, is the principal trade rule.
This is a massive conflict of interest scenario.
Let's break down what a principal trade actually is. We need to visualize this. Advisor Alice has a personal brokerage account. In her personal account, she owns 1,000 shares of a company called Tech Corp. She bought them cheap, and she thinks the price is about to drop, so she wants to sell them.
Now, Alice is also the fiduciary investment advisor for buyer Bob.
Alice looks at Bob's portfolio and says, "Bob, I advise you to buy 1,000 shares of Tech Corp." Bob agrees. But instead of going to the open stock market to buy those shares for Bob, Alice just transfers her own personal 1,000 shares of Tech Corp directly into Bob's account and takes Bob's cash.
She acted as a principal in the trade with her own client.
This is incredibly dangerous. How does Bob know he got a fair price? Alice was acting as his trusted advisor, telling him it was a great investment, but she was simultaneously acting as the seller, trying to offload her own stock, likely at the highest price possible.
She's playing both sides of the chessboard.
Because the potential for abuse is so high, The Uniform Securities Act puts a massive regulatory speed bump in the way of principal trades for advisors. It doesn't ban them completely, but it forces them into the light.
If an investment advisor acts as a principal for their own account, selling to or buying from a client, they must fulfill two strict requirements. First, they must provide written disclosure to the client regarding the capacity in which they are acting.
They have to confess they are the one on the other side of the trade.
Second, they must obtain the client's consent to the transaction. But here is the trap. The exam will try to trick you on the timing of this consent. Listen to this scenario and tell me if it's legal.
Let's hear it.
Bob comes into Alice's office to open his new advisory account. Alice hands him a 50-page stack of legal paperwork to sign. Buried on page 42 is a clause that says, "Client hereby gives blanket consent for advisor to occasionally execute principal trades from advisor's own inventory." Bob signs page 42. 6 months later, Alice dumps her TechCorp shares onto Bob. She says, "It's fine. He signed the consent form when he opened the account."
That is completely illegal. Blanket consent at the time of account opening is not valid for principal trades.
The rule requires disclosure and consent before the completion of each specific transaction.
It is a per-transaction requirement. The regulator wants Bob to have the opportunity to pause and question the conflict of interest every single time it happens.
If Alice wants to sell her TechCorp shares to Bob on Tuesday, she must disclose it and get Bob's specific consent before the Tuesday trade settles. If, on Thursday, she wants to buy some bonds out of Bob's account for her own personal portfolio, she cannot rely on Tuesday's consent.
She has to disclose and get a brand new consent for Thursday's trade.
It creates a high barrier of friction, which is exactly what the state wants when a fiduciary conflict of interest is present.
Now, I want to bring everything full circle. We are going to connect the principal trade rule back to the universal anti-fraud rule we talked about earlier. This is the final twist of the day, and it requires a deep understanding of the administrator's power.
Let's lay it out.
Earlier, we pounded the table.
Mm-hmm.
We stated unequivocally that there are never any exemptions to the core anti-fraud prongs. You can never be exempt from the ban on schemes to defraud. You can never be exempt from the ban on practices that operate as a fraud.
That remains an absolute truth. The administrator cannot waive fraud.
However, the principal trade disclosure rule is technically a procedural requirement built into the advisory section of the law. It is designed to prevent fraud, but failing to get a signature is a procedural violation, not inherently a scheme to defraud. Can the administrator grant an exemption to this specific procedural rule?
Yes, they can. And this is exactly the kind of nuanced distinction that separates passing scores from failing scores.
The administrator can, by rule or order, grant narrow exemptions from the principal transaction disclosure requirement itself.
They might do this for a specific type of highly liquid, completely transparent agency cross transaction where the risk of price manipulation is virtually zero.
So the administrator has the flexibility to waive a specific paperwork or consent requirement if they deem it unnecessary in a specific circumstance. But they can never, ever waive the core prohibition against actually deceiving the client.
They can flex the procedure. They can never flex the core anti-deceit rules.
We have covered a massive amount of regulatory ground today. We started with the blueprints and ended with fiduciary conflicts of interest. Now it is time to lock this information in. We were going to do a rapid-fire recap of the most highly testable concepts from this entire deep dive. I'm going to throw the concept, you spike it with the exam takeaway. Ready?
Let's lock it in.
Which version of the Uniform Securities Act is the foundation of the Series 63 exam?
The 1956 Act as amended by NASA. Ignore the 2002 version.
When a company successfully registers a security for sale, what is the correct legal term for the state's action?
The registration becomes effective. The state never approves, endorses, or recommends a security. Using those words is a violation.
True or false? If you are selling an exempt U.S. Treasury bond in an exempt private transaction, you are exempt from the anti-fraud provisions.
False. There are zero exemptions to the universal anti-fraud provision. If you lie or cheat, the state has jurisdiction, regardless of the exemptions.
The two-prong test for jurisdiction. Fraudster Fred in state A calls buyer Bob in state B. Who has jurisdiction?
Both states. The splash zone covers the state where the offer originates, state A, and the state where the offer is directed and received, state B.
Why does the buy-side jurisdictional test carry less weight than the sell-side test?
Because the buy-side does not trigger civil liability. A defrauded seller cannot sue a buyer for rescission under the USA. The civil remedy is designed to protect buyers.
The two-thirds media rule. A newspaper is printed in New York. 80% of its total circulation is shipped to New Jersey. Does New Jersey apply the two-thirds math?
No. For New Jersey, it is an out-of-state publication, so it is automatically excluded. The two-thirds math only applies to the publishing state, which is New York.
If an advisor's sloppy paperwork accidentally ruins a client's account, but they had no intent to steal, can they be sanctioned for fraud?
Yes. Prong 3 of the anti-fraud provision is effects-based. If a practice operates as a fraud, the administrator can take administrative action regardless of intent.
What is the maximum state criminal penalty under the USA? And what must the prosecutor prove?
The maximum is a $5,000 fine up to 3 years in prison or both. The prosecutor must prove the violation was willful.
And finally, when must an investment advisor obtain client consent for a principal trade?
Before the completion of each specific transaction, blanket consent at account opening is strictly prohibited.
Incredible. If you understand the mechanisms behind those concepts, you are going to absolutely crush this section of your exam. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Think about the cease and desist order we discussed earlier. The fact that a state administrator can issue an order shutting down a business without even holding a hearing first is an extraordinary grant of power. In most areas of law, due process requires a hearing before the government acts. But securities law is different because financial damage happens instantly.
If the universal anti-fraud rule is the ultimate backstop, the administrator is the ultimate goalie. When you sit down for the exam and you are staring at a question where the answer isn't immediately obvious, step back and look at the intent of the law. Always bet on the administrator having maximum jurisdictional authority to stop fraud and protect the public. They designed this 1956 blueprint specifically so they could catch the bad guys, no matter how many state lines they try to hide behind.
It is a complex regulatory web, but you have the map now.
Keep studying. Keep drilling those practice scenarios. And visualize Fred, Alice, and Bob when you get stuck. Good luck on your Series 63 prep, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.